The bond market is talking. The question is whether anybody's listening. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Good to have you along on this Tuesday, everybody. It is the 9th of January today, and I'm going to generalize here just a tad as we get going by pointing out that in economic news, as in life, you got your bright, shiny objects that get all the attention, and you got your worker bees just grinding things out. Our bright, shiny object right now, as you might imagine, is the stock market, about which, enough said. The bond market here is the worker bee. No muss, no fuss, just doing things the way they ought to be done. We start here because for the first time since last March, the yield, that is the interest rate on the government's 10-year Treasury note, topped 2.5% today. It is still relatively low, quite low even, big picture. But as Marketplace's Sabri Benishore reports, it is up. And therein, in that yield, lie some economic tea leaves.
Investors right now are demanding that they get higher returns on long-term loans to Uncle Sam. They are refusing to buy 10-year bonds unless the yield goes up.
Long-term Treasury yields generally have increased very dramatically, basically since the late summer months.
Richard DeKayser is corporate economist with Wells Fargo & Company. The question is, why are investors recently requiring higher payoffs for 10-year bonds?
I think if we're looking for a culprit, the most obvious one is the tax legislation just passed a couple of weeks ago.
The tax legislation is going to put the federal government at least $1 trillion more in debt, which means the government, over the next 10 years, is going to have to borrow at least $1 trillion more than it already does.
To attract those funds, they'll have to pay up, and the way that happens in the bond market is with higher interest rates.
Investors know the government is going to be hard-pressed to pay more later. So for bonds that extend several years into the future, they're demanding more now. Now, when bonds get cheaper and the payoff rises, which is happening now, this can start to scare stock market investors just a little.
Do I want to have as much in stocks, or should I put a little bit in these higher-yielding bonds now?
Jim Paulson is chief investment strategist at Luthold Group.
And if you start to get enough people doing that, it's going to bring selling pressure to bear in the stock market.
The other thing about bond market yields and interest rates is that after a while, they start to push up other interest rates in the economy.
The 3-year highs for treasuries are going to probably lead to eventually, if they hold, 3-year highs for mortgage yields.
Paulson says we shouldn't get ahead of ourselves here. We aren't anywhere near a high interest rate economy. But if the bond market is a crystal ball, which oftentimes it is, well, it's showing higher rates down the road. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
All right, we're going to make a little bit of a turn now to a related but slightly different topic, the Federal Reserve and how it does its job, or jobs, actually. The Fed's got, as I think we've said like a zillion times on this program, what is known as a dual mandate, maximum employment and stable prices. That second bit there, stable prices, has, since the days of Ben Bernanke, officially meant inflation at 2%. Unofficially, 2% has been the inflation target for a good while longer in this economy. And there is some talk now, though, about how the Fed might be changing its approach to the prices that we all eventually pay. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson is here to explain. Hey, Tracy.
Hey, Kai.
All right, so hook me up and help me understand, first of all, as we get going, why, how, where we got this 2% goal in the first place.
Yeah. So inflation, you can think about it as a little bit of a Goldilocks thing. Like, you don't want too much of it, but you also don't want too little. So too much inflation, especially without wage growth, means your money's just worth less. It can't buy as much as it used to. But you want some low level of inflation. That's kind of considered healthy for the economy. It's associated with economic growth and wage increases. But why 2% specifically?
Yeah.
It's admittedly like a bit of an arbitrary number. It does.
oh good. That's much better. That's great.
Yeah, arbitrary. It's some low level of inflation. It gives the Fed a goal to shoot for, a target to think about when they're setting interest rates, which, of course, affects all of us.
Right, right. And the catch now, of course, is that there has not been any real inflation in this economy for a good number of years. So where is all the talk of change coming from?
Yeah, just yesterday, in fact, the Boston and San Francisco Fed presidents both argued that this target should be changed. Even in the past chair, Ben Bernanke, has suggested revisiting this policy. The idea here, it's basically to give the Fed a little bit more flexibility in how it manages the economy and also how it is able to stimulate the economy in the case of a future recession. So the how of this part, it gets really technical really fast. We're going to kind of stay away from that. But if you think back to that dual mandate that you mentioned, The Fed wants the economy to grow. It wants companies to create jobs, to hire people. It also worries about inflation. The problem is growth and inflation, they can go hand in hand. And so the two goals of the Fed can sort of be in tension with each other. The idea here is that maybe if the Fed has more flexibility on this inflation piece, maybe it can do better at the second piece at managing the economy.
Right. So are they just going to go in a meeting and say, all right, what about this? I mean, how are they going to figure out what they want the inflation target or range, I suppose, to be?
Yeah. I think we're going to be hearing a lot about this for a while. This is the start of a discussion. There's, broadly speaking, about three different options on the table. So the Fed could just simply increase the target from 2% to something like 3 or 4%.
Yeah.
The thing is, as you mentioned, we haven't been hitting that target for a while. So the idea of raising it is kind of interesting. The Fed could create a range instead of a target to, again, give itself more flexibility. So maybe like 1.5% to 2% or 3%. And there's a third idea, which is a little bit trickier, and that's that we switch from something called inflation to something called price level targeting. And the big difference here, it sounds similar to inflation targeting, but instead of having an inflation target of 2% every year and, you know, if we miss that target next year, the target's still 2%, this would mean we'd shoot for price increases of 2% each year. And if we miss it, the next year we try and make up the difference.
Wow. It's like an accounting game, right? If you think about what the Fed's trying to do here.
Yeah, they're trying to, you know, of course they want to communicate with investors and the public about what they're doing. They also need to get us to understand what they're doing. And that piece is, it's going to be a challenge for them.
Jay Powell, by the way, as long as we're talking about the Fed, Jay Powell takes over, in like 3 weeks, yeah?
Yeah, early next month.
All right. Tracy Samuelson in New York talking about the Fed. Thanks, Tracy.
Thanks, Kai.
On Wall Street today, the 10-year, as I said, at 2.5%. We'll do stocks later. Got to be consistent, right? Details, numbers, you know the drill. All right, we're going to do a tax story now that's a little bit public policy, a little bit personal economy, and a little bit the law of very much intended political consequences. Residents of New York City pay some of the highest taxes in the country, in return for which they have some of the most expensive public services in the country. A $10 billion police force, 24/7 public transit when it works, guaranteed shelters for the homeless, and a public health care corporation as well. The city also has one of the most progressive tax systems around. The more you have, the more you pay. In fact, the top 1% of that city's economic pyramid pays nearly half of the city's income taxes. Except now there is a new federal tax law that you might have heard of. Marketplace's Ryan Kyloff explains what's going on.
Diane Gilman was born in California in 1945.
I came from an era where the word career woman, I mean, that hadn't even been invented yet. And yet from the time I was about 3 years old, I knew exactly what I wanted to do.
At the store with her mom, she saw a 17 magazine.
Teenage model takes over Fifth Avenue in New York. And I remember pulling my mother's coat and I said, you see that? That's going to be me. I'm going to live on Fifth Avenue in a big, beautiful home. Took a while.
Gilman moved to New York at age 30 to work in fashion. She was a department store clerk during the day and a waitress at night, designed clothes on the side, and had her career ups and downs. She was almost 50 when she made it.
It was beyond my wildest dreams.
Gilman was invited to sell her denim line on the Home Shopping Network.
I am now the longest living fashion personality on teleretailing.
24 years and counting. She says her line, DG2, clears about $100 million a year, and she takes home more than 1.5. Last year, at age 71, Gilman finally got her big, beautiful home on Fifth Avenue, just like she told her mother.
And the pleasure I got from saying, oh, what apartment do you live in? Penthouse! Did I say that loud enough? Penthouse! That was like the real dream come true. And now Donald Trump is probably going to take that away from me.
Under the new tax law, Gilman says she'll pay nearly 20% more after taking a hit on the state and local and mortgage interest deductions. She knows how it sounds when she complains.
So a few snooty elites in New York and San Francisco have to pay more taxes. Big deal. Who cares about them?
Republicans tend to agree with that. But as it turns out, her state and local governments care very much.
It is an economic civil war.
New York Governor Andrew Cuomo last week.
This could cause people to leave the state of New York, and it could reduce our ability to attract business.
Losing that deduction is going to raise taxes on the, you know, upper income taxpayers hundreds of thousands, if not millions.
Bob Willens is a high-end tax lawyer in New York, and he's talking about the loss of the state and local income tax deduction. He says talk of leaving the city is more common and more serious than he's ever seen it. In the past, studies showed that only around 3% of the wealthy actually followed through on threats to flee high taxes. But Willens says this time feels different.
We've never had a situation quite like this one where such an important deduction was taken away.
And because the rich provide such a high proportion of New York's tax revenue, even a few high-net-worth individuals leaving can be felt in local budgets. And that's before you get to the question of whether businesses will now build or expand into high-tax communities. Take Amazon and its search for a new headquarters, for example.
There were sort of cascading effects.
Michael Jacobson at the City University of New York says beyond money leaving New York or deciding not to come here, the drain on revenue from the new tax law will come from other indirect angles.
People will be spending less money to make up for the additional taxes they have to pay.
That'll reduce sales tax revenue. A Moody's report says now that the deductions on property taxes and mortgage interest are limited, housing prices in Manhattan could drop nearly 10% next year, which will hit property tax revenue.
It comes at you from so many directions that it can only be bad.
Jacobson says in response, governments will have to cut services or raise taxes. New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio has been pushing hard for a so-called millionaire's tax.
He's going to have a revolution on his hands if he raises taxes.
When I tell Diane Gilman people in her tax bracket provide nearly half the city's income tax revenue, she says she feels blessed. But at the end of the day, she still wants a lower tax bill. So she's exploring the idea of a new penthouse in Tampa. On Fifth Avenue, I'm Ryan Kailath for Marketplace.
Yes, the economic headlines are important, but honestly, they don't mean much without a little bit of context, without knowing what those headlines mean in the economic day-to-day. That's the basic idea behind our series, My Economy. Today's installment comes to us from Oakland, California.
My name is Stephanie Good. For work, I freelance doing various things related to IT design. And then when I'm not doing that, I'm working in my very, very small farm. And it's a small operation. It's not a money-making operation, but it is intensive. I brought a couple chickens with me from my friend's small farm, and then I decided to get my own chicks and start my own flock. The problem started when I got the new young birds, and that's when the fun starts. One of the original birds, who was probably, she seemed to have some kind of intelligence I could be projecting, but she just flipped, and she didn't want to have anything to do with these young birds, and she got in the way of their being able to naturally go into the egg box and start laying, and unfortunately, we had to remove her from the flock. I saw that exchanging eggs for other goods, it's kind of like a gateway. People understand, like, this is something worth, that has value, and I'm willing to give you something in exchange. Like if I have to be out of town and I have somebody or multiple people helping me out with homesteading, I give them eggs. And people also offer, if I, you know, can I trade you for goat milk? I have friends who are, say, into pickling, and so we'll exchange for pickles. Or, you know, it's different things. It's an open secret that you can grow your own food and that you can invite other people to participate in it, as long as you're willing to get dirty.
The barter economy. We'd love to hear your story of how you are getting by. Let us know. Marketplace.org/myeconomy. Coming up.
Drove around LA and observed a lot of annoying behavior, as you do.
As you do on the way to the good place. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials added 0.4%, 102 points, closed at 25,385. Did the blue chips. NASDAQ up less than 0.1%, 6.7163. S&P 500 gained about 0.1%, 3 points, 2751. Airplane space is getting even tighter, as you know, if you're a passenger. Also, though, for cargo, global air freight traffic rose almost 9% year over year for the year ended in November. And yet, FedEx slowed down 0.3% today. UPS basically flat. Bond prices, just because that's where we started, well, they fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose 2.55%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. It occurs to me as I stand here that the theme of the program today is markets, or market forces, really, and the power that they have. Example, I guess three for us in the show today, is the energy market. Federal regulators have disposed of a Trump administration proposal to subsidize struggling coal and nuclear power companies. The Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, FERC in the vernacular, is an independent five-member agency, four of whose commissioners right now are Trump appointees. Nevertheless, the vote against the Department of Energy plan to subsidize those companies was unanimous. Marketplace's Aaron Trank explains the market forces reality at work here.
The Department of Energy said to prevent electrical grid vulnerability and avoid blackouts, the FERC should approve a special subsidy for power plants that can keep several months' fuel supply on hand. Basically, that means coal and nuclear power. But Trevor Hauser at the Rhodium Group says DOE's own data show that's a way overblown concern.
Of all the customer hours of lost electricity supply, less than 0.00007% were due to fuel supply emergencies.
On coal specifically, the FERC said propping up expensive plants doesn't make sense when there are cheaper alternatives, like lots of natural gas.
All five FERC commissioners rightly concluded that it was unfair to force electricity consumers to pay higher prices if there was going to be no real benefit in terms of grid reliability.
The Department of Energy proposal was a long-shot attempt by the Trump team to keep the ailing coal industry on life support, says John Moore at the Natural Resources Defense Council.
On economics alone, coal power is fighting a losing battle, and that's exactly why the Department of Energy went to FERC to try to find a way to bail out the power plants.
More than half of the power plants that have been retired in recent years are coal-fired. Matthew Preston is a coal analyst at Wood Mackenzie. He says if FERC had accepted DOE's proposal, coal would have seen a little boost.
Coal plants would have been supported in their existence over a longer period of time, whereas now, if a coal plant is financially troubled, closure is one of the major options.
Without the DOE subsidy, dozens of struggling coal and nuclear facilities will likely move forward with plans to close. I'm Aaron Schrank for Marketplace.
For those of us, yours truly included here, who still keep an eye on the good old broadcast television calendar in this age of streaming and on-demand, some favorite series have started coming back from their winter hiatuses. On that list is The Good Place on NBC, back for season two, a creation of Michael Schur, who you might know from his other work, The Office, Parks and Rec, Brooklyn Nine-Nine. Mike Schur, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
I should have said welcome back, because we had you on like five-ish years ago when Brooklyn Nine-Nine started.
That's right, yes.
Doing anything much since?
Brooklyn's still going. We just passed our 100th episode, although we celebrated with our 99th episode, too, which is fun. You
yes.
get it. Good.
I'm no dope, man. I'm no dope. I catch up.
I just put the finishing touches on the second season of a show called The Good Place, which airs on NBC, which is my current sort of main project.
So The Good Place, which is why I thought to speak with you. Were you just sitting around one day and said, and I'm getting at creative process here, sitting around one day and you said, so let's do a show about this utopia kind of place with a girl who shouldn't really be there shows up and we'll cast Kristen Bell and Ted Danson. Is that the way that happens?
If only it were that easy. The way it happened was I spent a lot of, after Parks and Recreation, which was my last show ended, I drove around L.A. and just existed in the universe and observed a lot of annoying behavior, as you do. Mm-hmm. People cutting you off in traffic and people throwing things on the ground and not picking up after themselves. And I had this game I played with myself where I would just say, that's negative 8 points. Like, if anyone's keeping score, that what you did right there, right. sir, cutting me off in traffic, that you just lost 8 points. And I started thinking about a world where actions have actual just point values that can be measured and analyzed and broken down. And that led me to the afterlife, and I thought, what if it's a game, and the people with the highest scores get into the good place, and people with the lowest scores get into the bad place? One thing led to another, and then I came up with this idea that a woman who wasn't great gets into the great place and sort of
because there's been like a bookkeeping error?
Some kind of clerical error is what it appears to be. I don't want to give away too many spoilers.
Yeah, no.
At first, what it appears to be is some kind of clerical error, and that she has to figure out how to become a good person in order to stay.
When you finally came up with your pitch, because you are Mike Schur of Parks and Rec fame, et cetera, I imagine people said, yes, please come do the show with us.
Well, you're very kind to say that. The actual situation was when Parks and Recreation ended, NBC asked me to do another show for them and sort of promised me that I could kind of skip the line, as it were, and just get a show on the air.
So the answer to your question, Kai, is yes.
Yes, yeah. They basically said, we'll give you a 13-episode guarantee, which is a very rare thing, and I felt very fortunate. And so I'm a hard worker, I would say. And so I spent a lot of time crafting the idea because I wanted to not feel like I was taking advantage of their generosity.
You said 13-episode season. I thought standard TV episode seasons were 22 episodes.
Until very recently, that was the case. But the way that the world is moving, in part because of Netflix, Amazon,
fast,
Hulu.
Fast, 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 baby. Right?
Fast. And also, it used to be that you did that many episodes in a season because there was this mad dash to 100. 100 was the magic number to get to syndication.
Right.
Now, it's less. There's the syndication market kind of doesn't exist. What does exist is Hulu and Amazon and Netflix. So they don't care how many episodes you have. They just pay you per season and per episode. So it's less important that you do so many so quickly. It's more important that you make them good.
You are a showrunner. Is that the right word?
Yeah. It's an unofficial term. It's not.
That means you're a made man. Right?
If you so much as threaten me, a bunch of other showrunners will show up. And
how do you learn how to do that?
From someone who's already doing it. There's no other way. Or there's a sort of sink or swim aspect to it. Like, TV creation is the only world where you can literally not have ever done it before, and then 1 second later, you're in charge of basically a corporation with about 150 employees.
That doesn't seem very smart.
Sometimes it works out really well, and sometimes it's not so good. But in my case, I learned it by watching Greg Daniels and just seeing, like, here's what he did and here's how he does it. And it's, by the way, it's appropriate for this show because you have to, it's not just a creative enterprise. It's an economic enterprise.
Yeah.
You're in charge of your budget, and you need to make decisions about what you value and how much you value it, and you have to fight for more money, and you have to make deals, and there's a lot that goes on that is sort of, you learn only by doing it.
That's so funny. You have to fight for more money. I always just imagine that the for-profit land is like, here, have as much money as you want.
Oh, no. No, the opposite. They are trying to minimize the amount of money that they spend on your product. And take, for example, like a hiatus week. So you shoot 4 or 5 episodes in a row, and then you have a built-in hiatus week where the writing staff can sort of regroup and regenerate, and you have a little more time to relax. Those hiatus weeks are expensive because you have to pay to hold your crew across that week. You can't just... So those hiatus weeks are several $100,000 of money that's just being thrown away. Not thrown away, given to the crew.
Not productively.
Right, and so what happens when they want to cut costs? Well, they start saying, do you really need that hiatus week? Yeah. Or can it be 3 hiatus days and then we start shooting on Thursday? So you have to know everything about the way the economics of the show work in order to be able to fight for the territory that you really need.
Huh. How do you feel about TV right now? There's this whole peak TV thing and so much content and so many opportunities for content providers to get stuff out. What's your sense?
It's great for people like me. It's great for consumers because they have more options than ever, and everything is on demand.
Yeah.
The question that I have, and I think that everybody has, is the growth sustainable? I mean, we've gone from 150 shows were eligible for the Emmys, 10 years ago or something. It's now over 500.
Really?
And that's just scripted. Then forget about unscripted documentaries. Mm-hmm. Netflix is making movies now. There's all sorts of entertainment options that didn't exist 10 years ago. My question is, I mean, we don't have time. None of us have time to watch all of the TV.
Right.
If you read reviews of TV now, you say, like, well, there's probably 30 shows that people are saying, this is a wonderful, amazing, incredible show that you actually have to watch now. None of us have time for that in our lives. So I don't know whether we can keep growing this fast.
Mike Schur, you know him from, a bunch of stuff. Parks and Rec, The Office, most recently, The Good Place. Mike, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
final note on the way out today, in which I am very pleased to be able to tell you that the name of this program is being changed. We are now officially, this is actually true, Market Blockchain Place. You laugh, I hear you, but corporate America's love affair with the technology behind Bitcoin is the new thing, as you might not be aware. Today's example is Eastman Kodak, the remnants of the once great but then bankrupt photography pioneer. They announced this morning they are going blockchain with something called Kodak Coin, which the company says could be used for a new photography licensing payment system, which is great. Traders, though, did not care about the details. They are just all about the blockchain. Kodak shares up 119% on the day. Remember, Market Blockchain Place. I think, honestly, we're going to call them, here it is, ready? Riz Dollars. Next step for us, initial coin offering, I'm telling you. All right, the Dow up 0.4% today, about 102 points. NASDAQ up less than 0.1%, 6 points. S&P 500 up 0.1%, 3 points there. Our digital team includes Sarah Menendez, Donna Tam, and Tony Wagner. Ben Hethcote is our digital visual producer. Sarah Muti is our executive director of digital. Cesar Nieves is the executive director of On Demand. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.